Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Kathy Kitts, and you're listening to The Resilient Brain. We come to you every Saturday at noon, and our show is 1 hour long. And we talk about all aspects of the brain, even the business brain, the spiritual brain, how the brain learns, different topics within that broad subject matter of the brain. So today, my weekly weather report goes kind of like this. It looks kind of hazy outside, and to be honest, I haven't been out yet. It was actually less humid yesterday than it had been all week, but I think we're back to some humid weather based on the color of the sky, and I do think it's going to be another hot one going up to about 90 degrees. So just the combination of the humidity, especially with the high temperature, makes it most unpleasant for me and I think for a lot of people. Even my dog, he doesn't want to go to walk as far as he normally would. He kind of stops halfway through and he's panting, and I know he's extra hot. I mean, can you imagine wearing a fur coat in this weather? And that's what he has to do, so he's probably, you know, really overheated and wants to return home. So, but funny enough, he doesn't always go right to his water bowl. So, interesting. Now, last week I took a break from reading Patricia Wolf's Brain Matters, and I discussed and read to you excerpts from My Stroke of Insight, which is written by Jill Bolt Taylor. And Jill is the one who had a stroke herself, and she is a neuroanatomist. So it was a most interesting story, and I read some excerpts from the part where she describes what it was like being without the left side of her brain, which had been injured completely just about by her stroke. But we're back again to Brain Matters, because I haven't finished talking about the various parts of the brain, which I had started a couple weeks ago, and I thought I would continue until we are finished with that. But just as a way to review, we talked about the cerebral cortex, and that is six layers thick, and it's what we call gray matter, and it's that outer part of the brain, all over the brain. It's called the cerebral cortex. And the occipital lobes, which are located at the very back of your head, those are the ones that process visual stimuli. And then temporal lobes, which are right above, right where your temple is, and sort of around that area goes, stretches from your temple, from your temporal area to almost the back of your head. It actually touches the occipital lobes in the back. But those lobes are responsible for taking, you know, processing auditory stimulus or stimuli. So, and just to reiterate, there are two special areas on the left side of your temporal lobe, on the left side of your brain. And one is called Wernicke's area, and that is critical for speech. It allows us to comprehend or interpret speech and to put words together in correct syntax when speaking. And then another area, Broca's area, which is on the left side of the brain as well, is necessary to produce speech. So there's, you know, two different specialized areas in the production of speech and in the understanding of speech that comes to us. So now we're up to the parietal lobes, and what they begin talking about is sometimes as a result of a stroke in the right hemisphere of the brain, persons are left with a strange disorder called anosognosia. Anosognosia, meaning lack of knowledge of illness. These people are often paralyzed on the left side of their bodies, but are unaware of their problem. They treat the left side of their bodies as if it wasn't there, refusing to comb their hair on that side, or even refusing to put clothes on that half of the body. To understand how this strange disorder could occur, we need to look at the part of the cortex that handles spatial awareness and orientation. And I don't think a lot of us think about spatial awareness or orientation that often until we hear of somebody who has a situation like this, or, you know, we have something similar ourselves going on. But at the top of the brain is a flat, plate-like area in each hemisphere called the parietal lobe. And it actually does go onto the side of your brain a little bit as well. These lobes consist of two major subdivisions, the anterior or front part and posterior or back part. And they each play different but complementary roles. Within the anterior or front part of the parietal lobes, immediately behind the motor cortex, lies a strip of cells called the somatosensory cortex. And it's just a little strip that goes across your head. Just as we need to send information to the muscles in our body about when and how to move, we also need to be able to receive information, such as touch and temperature, from our environment, sensations of pain and pressure from the skin, and the positions of our limbs, which is proprioception. And that one, you know, most people aren't familiar with proprioception, but that is, in fact, where you are in space. So, and that has a lot to do with your sense of touch as well. So this is accomplished by this area called the somatosensory cortex, the primary region responsible for receiving incoming sensory stimuli. Each part of the body is represented by a specific area on the surface of the somatosensory cortex. The more sensitive a part of the body, the greater the area needed to interpret its message. For example, the lips, tongue, and throat have the largest number of receptors. Damage to this part of a parietal lobe interferes with the perception of touch and pain and with the knowledge of the body's position in space. Now, I do want to take a moment to say that, again, this is the Resilient Brain, and we are brought to you in part by New Growth Center for Brain Training. And if you'd like to call in to ask a question or make a comment or simply to listen to the show, you can do that simply by calling 602-753-1726. Again, it's 602-753-1726. So the posterior or the rear part of the parietal lobes continuously analyzes and integrates all this information to give you a sense of spatial awareness. So this is that part that totally, you know, helps you to know where you are in space. Like, for example, if you're sitting in a chair, how far away is the wall, in, you know, behind you, those kinds of things. The brain must know at all times where each part of the body is located and its relation to its surroundings. And that was most interesting to me for this Stroke of Insight book, because Dr. Taylor says how she felt like she really wasn't a solid anymore. She felt like she was a liquid, and she didn't know where she stopped and something other than her began. So a complete lack of being able to tell, you know, spatial awareness of her own body. So damage to this part of the parietal lobes often results in clumsiness in manipulating objects, which is also called apraxia. A final role of the parietal lobes is in maintaining focus or spatial attention. When one is focused on a particular stimulus, or when attention shifts from location to location, activation of the parietal lobes can be seen through brain imaging techniques. As a stimulus becomes less meaningful, however, the attention wanes. For example, if you are wearing shoes that are tight or painful, your focus will be maintained on your feet. But if you take off the tight shoes, the sensory receptors stop sending so much information, and your attention shifts to something else. And now we are going to, what most people consider some of the most interesting lobes, most important. But of course, we need to have them all to really function completely well. And that is the frontal lobe. So the frontal lobes are located, if you put your hand on your forehead, it's that area behind your forehead. And it extends back almost to the middle of your brain. So those are big lobes. And so that's what this says, too. The frontal lobes occupy the largest part of the cortex, 28%, and perform the most complex functions. Located in the front of the brain and extending back to the top of the head, the frontal lobe has expanded rapidly over the past 20,000 generations and is what most clearly distinguishes us from our forefathers. Your ability to move parts of your body at will, think about the past, plan for the future, focus your attention, reflect, make decisions, solve problems, and engage in conversation are all possible because of this highly developed area of your brain. But perhaps more amazing than any of these functions is the fact that the frontal lobes of the cerebral cortex are what allow you to be consciously aware of all these thoughts and actions. And they say that this is what separates us from animals, that animals are not consciously aware of their awareness. And we are. We are aware that we are conscious and we can think about our thoughts. So it's a little step above, although I don't think we give animals enough credit. I think that animals, make up for a lot of that, especially our pets, by being able to read our nonverbal signals quite well. And to some degree, I do think that they're able to pick up on our thoughts. So, my husband and a friend of mine, too, have said that when the pets are bothering them and they're not sure what they're bothering them about, a little picture of their food will pop into their brain, and they feel that the animals are sending that message to them, which is very interesting. I don't disagree. I don't think that that's just myth. I think some people are more able to pick up on things like that than others. The functions of the frontal lobes fall into two main categories: sensory motor processing and cognition. Toward the back of the frontal lobes is a strip of cells that stretches across the top of the brain, forming a sort of band along a path just in front of the ears, like the connecting pieces in earphones. This strip is known as the motor cortex. So just to review for you, when we talked about the parietal lobes, we talked about the front of those parietal lobes having the somatosensory cortex, and that is a strip. But then right in front of this somatosensory cortex is the motor cortex. So it's right in front of that, and so we need to know what that's about. Known as the motor cortex, nearly all neural activity directing muscular movement originates in the brain's motor cortex. So I think before I may have mentioned the cerebellum, that little brain that sits at the very base of your brain in the back of your head, and a lot of its responsibilities cover movement. But here we have another section in the cerebral cortex, which is responsible for the neural activity. So nearly all neural activity directing muscular movement originates in the brain's motor cortex. And it could be that those messages go through the thalamus and then back out to the cerebellum. Let's see if it mentions anything. Different areas of this strip govern the movements of specific muscles in the body. Similar to the somatosensory cortex, every part of your body, from your toes up to your lips, has a corresponding region in the motor cortex, but all parts of the body are not equally represented. Certain muscles must carry out much more precise fine motor movements than others, so the areas of the motor cortex controlling these muscles are disproportionately large. For example, the areas governing the fingers, lips, and tongue are much larger than the area governing the small of the back, because the small of the back doesn't have to carry out precise motions, whereas our tongue, especially, you know, when we're eating, we have to, you know, move the tongue around, we have to taste the food. You know, we have to maybe move the food back to the back of our mouth. It really does have a lot to do with how we eat. And so because the small of the back doesn't have to carry out precise motions, it doesn't have as much of the area of the motor cortex, you know, connected to that. So just in front of the motor cortex is a supplemental motor area. A supplemental motor area. This area contains an extremely important group of nerve cells known as Broca's area. So remember I talked about Wernicke's area in the temporal lobe, and that there's also Broca's area for making speech. So they're bringing this back up again, the Broca's area. This is the part of the cortex that allows you to speak. Broca's area is located in the left hemisphere of the supplemental motor area in about 95% of the population. The other 5%, approximately 30% of left-handed persons, have the speech production area in the right hemisphere. That's interesting. So it's saying that it's in the supplemental motor area, but it's that area is also intersects with the temporal lobe. So it's probably not surprising to find that Broca's area is connected to Wernicke's area in the temporal lobes by a bundle of nerve fibers. This linkage is important because any speech can be uttered. Its form and the appropriate words must first be assembled in Wernicke's area and then relayed to Broca's area to be translated into the proper sounds. This information is then passed to the motor cortex for vocal production. The large part of the frontal lobes, situated in front of the secondary motor zones, has sometimes been called the silent area, meaning it is free from processing sensory data and governing movement. Called the prefrontal cortex, it is proportionately much larger in humans than in other species. So they're talking about, you know, in front of this strip of the motor cortex, that whole front part is called the prefrontal cortex. So, and it's proportionally much larger in humans than in other species. This may be the part of our brains that most clearly defines what it means to be human, the part that separates us from animals. As Sandra Ackerman in her book Discovering the Brain states, humans have the least stereotyped, most flexible lifestyle of all animal species, and it is believed that the cortex must in some way be related to liberating the individual from the fixed predetermined patterns of behavior. The prefrontal cortex is sometimes called the association cortex. It is here that information is synthesized from both the inner and outer sensory worlds. That associations between objects and their names are made, and that the highest forms of mental activities take place. Our human cortex allows us to build cathedrals, compose symphonies, dream and plan for a better future, love, hate, and experience emotional pain. Because it is in the cortex, that consciousness, our ability to be aware of what we are thinking, feeling, and doing, emerges. So recent findings have implicated a part of the prefrontal cortex as critical for emotional self-regulation. The orbitofrontal cortex, so named because of its proximity to the eye socket, or orbit, appears to have the responsibility for evaluating and regulating the emotional impulses emanating from the lower centers of the brain. This new finding regarding the orbitofrontal cortex deserves our attention and study. It may eventually help us understand everyday failures of self-regulation, such as road rage in adults or temper tantrums in children. It is possible that these inappropriate responses are the result of an injury to the brain, causing a sort of short-circuiting of the wiring of the orbitofrontal cortex. Genetic predisposition also may be a contributing factor. Some researchers believe, however, that the most common determiner of failure to self-regulate emotional response is the lack of emotionally consistent parenting in the early years. So the lack of emotionally consistent parenting in the early years is considered to be the main reason why some people can't regulate their emotions. Many parts of the brain must work together in a complex set of interactions for us to engage in a seemingly simple act. For example, Broca's area, Wernicke's area, and the motor cortex all must work together for us to speak a sentence. The same is true of walking across a room, lifting a glass, or recognizing a friend. Although the structure and function of the major structures of the brain have been addressed separately here, it is extremely important to remember that no structure works alone in this complex system. Yes, you can picture all of these areas as having nerve bundle connections to various other parts of the brain, and that's how, you know, the whole brain knows what's going on, and that's how they make communication to different parts of the brain. So, you know, even though we know there are some assignments to the left side versus the right side of the brain, there are a lot of interconnections. So you can't say, you know, it's just strictly one or the other. Are we of two minds? Throughout this chapter and the previous one, we noted that the various structures of the brain come in pairs. The exception is the single pineal gland, which led Socrates to designate it as the seat of the soul. And people who are into spiritual development still believe that the pineal gland has something to do with the soul. Looking down from the top, the whole brain appears to be composed of two seemingly identical halves. A deep groove, known as the longitudinal fissure, runs the length of the brain and travels nearly halfway down into its center, dividing the brain into two parts resembling an enormous walnut. Functions and roles of these two halves, known as the right and left hemispheres, has been debated for centuries. As early as 400 BC, Hippocrates wrote about the possibility of the duality of the human brain. In 1874, Englishman John Hewlings Jackson, Englishman John Hewlings Jackson introduced the idea of the brain having a leading hemisphere. And even today, to a lesser degree, it was common to hear people referred to as right-brained or left-brained, generally signifying that they were predominantly verbal and analytical, which is left-brained, or artistic and emotional, which is right-brained. This idea of a rigid right-left divide spawned a small industry of books and courses with topics such as drawing on the right side of the brain or developing a right-brained management style, all designed to encourage right-brained activity and thinking. Even educators attempted to direct more of their instruction to the right side of the brain. As sometimes happens with many new theories, we took a complex subject and, with good intentions, generated applications that were far removed from the actual scientific research. Scientists even have coined a name for the unbridled enthusiasm for our two brains. They call it dichotomania. None of these theories and ideas about the roles of the hemispheres was totally inaccurate or totally accurate. Over the past two decades, a large body of research has emerged on the roles of the cerebral hemispheres. As often happens, the more we study any part of the brain, the more we learn just how complex it is. Our hemispheres are no exception. New findings have caused some of the major researchers and writers in this field to modify their earlier views. Which of the older views still hold true, and what new information do we have about the hemispheres and their function? It has long been known, for the most part, that left hemisphere of the brain governs the right side of the body and the right hemisphere the left. We've also known that the two hemispheres are joined by several bundles of fibers known as commissures. The largest of these is a 4-inch-long bundle of fibers known as the corpus callosum. The corpus callosum is the largest fiber system in the brain. It is composed of about 300 million axons, the appendage of neurons that are responsible for sending messages to other cells. This much information has been around for a long time, but the realization that each hemisphere has specialties and is relatively new. In the early 1960s, several neuroscientists at the California Institute of Technology were looking for ways to control epileptic seizures. Epileptic seizures, or electrical disturbances in one hemisphere, often cross over the corpus callosum and trigger a seizure in the other hemisphere. Roger Sperry, a neuroscience researcher, along with neurosurgeons, something kind of took my attention. I hope my dog is not eating something he's not supposed to, because that is a big pile of something. Interesting. What in the world could he be doing? Well, I guess I'll have to check after the show. So, epileptic seizures or electrical disturbances in one hemisphere often cross over the corpus callosum and trigger a seizure in the other hemisphere. Roger Sperry, a neuroscience researcher, along with neurosurgeons Joseph Bogan and Philip Vogel, speculated that cutting through the corpus callosum might prevent the electrical activity from crossing between hemispheres and thus stop or minimize the seizures. They guessed right. After the surgery to sever the corpus callosum, the patient's symptoms diminished considerably. and the patients appeared to function perfectly well in their daily activities. But studies on these split-brain patients revealed that something unusual had happened. If the patients held an object, such as a pencil, hidden from sight in their right hands, they could name and describe it. But when the pencil was held in the left hand out of sight, they claimed they held nothing. This finding was puzzling and led to further studies on these split-brain patients. Much of this research was conducted by Roger Sperry and his colleagues, Michael Gazzaniga, and Joseph Bogan, and it led to an understanding that the two hemispheres are indeed specialized in what they do. From this research, we now believe that the reason split-brain patients could not name the pencil when it was out of sight in the left hand is that the left hand communicates largely with the right hemisphere. This hemisphere is limited in its ability to produce speech. Therefore, when the corpus callosum is severed and the hemispheres can't communicate with one another, the silent right hemisphere doesn't allow the person to name the object. And recall that for approximately 95% of the population, the left hemisphere is dominant for language and speech, while the roles are reversed in some left-handers. Further research revealed other specializations of the hemispheres as well. Melodies are perceived better in the left ear right hemisphere than in the right ear left hemisphere. Huh. So if you hold up the phone to your left ear, you'll hear melodies better. Emotions appear to be lateralized as well, with the right hemisphere processing the more negative emotions and the left more positive and optimistic ones. That's interesting, too. So if you're feeling negative emotionally, that's coming more from the right side of your brain. And persons with left hemisphere damage have difficulty recognizing faces, while damage to the right hemisphere often causes people to have to be finding their way around. Well, I think some people have trouble finding their way around, period. So I don't know if they have damaged right parts of their brain or not, but probably one of the most critical aspects of hemispheric specialization is the issue of context. Our understanding of what we read or our comprehension of what we hear depends on the context within which it occurs. For example, the comment, "Oh, that's wonderful," can be expressed with joy or with sarcasm. Unless you can compute the context through body language, the intonation of the person speaking, or the sentence that preceded it in the narrative, the sentence is virtually meaningless. Interestingly, it is the right hemisphere that decodes the external information, allowing us to create an overall understanding of what is said or what we read. The right hemisphere allows us to get the joke or to respond appropriately to a comment. So I wonder if when you're speaking another language, a lot of times, you know, you don't get the jokes in another language. And I know people who, you know, English is the second language for them, and they don't get a great number of jokes. So I wonder if that has something to do with the right hemisphere being where you get the joke or to respond appropriately to a comment. This is the hemisphere that assembles the whole field of view, allowing us to see the forest as well as the individual trees. The right hemisphere gives us an overall view of the world. So again, big picture, right hemisphere, and little details, left hemisphere. The research on split-brain patients is interesting, but what about the vast majority of us who have an intact corpus callosum? Are our hemispheres lateralized in the same way? Researcher Robert Ornstein has done extensive studies of normal people using EEGs that validate the findings generated by studying the split brain patients. Ornstein and his colleagues asked people to perform simple tasks, such as writing a letter to a friend, left hemisphere, or arranging blocks into a pattern, right hemisphere, and recorded their brain waves as they worked. The researchers compared alpha waves, indicating an awake brain on idle, and beta waves, an awake brain actively processing information, during these two activities. When writing a letter, the left hemisphere showed more beta activity and the right more alpha. The opposite was true when the person was arranging blocks. Ornstein characterizes this phenomenon as a turning on of the hemispheres primarily responsible for a particular action, while the other hemisphere temporarily turns off. Although it now seems clear that our hemispheres each have their specialties, we must remember that they work in concert at all times. In your brain right now, the information arriving in one hemisphere is immediately available to the other side. The responses of the two hemispheres are so closely coordinated that they produce a single view of the world, not two. For example, when you are engaged in conversation, it is your left hemisphere that allows you to produce speech, but it is your right hemisphere that gives the intonation to your speech. Okay, so we know that the Broca's area is what allows us to produce speech, but the intonation, which is the finer part of it, is given by the right hemisphere. This, in turn, allows your listeners to use their right hemispheres to judge the context and fully comprehend the intended meaning of your words. The specializations of each hemisphere develop to their fullest when informed by the opposite hemisphere. The two halves of your brain work together in a beautifully coordinated partnership. This collaboration is described by Robert Ornstein in his book, The Right Mind, and I quote, "They are in the same body after all, even though they're a couple of inches apart. They have the same cerebellum, the same brainstem, the same spinal cord. Each half of the human brain shares years of experience with the other. They eat the same cereal in the morning and the same burger at lunch, and thus receive the same changes in their blood supply. They share the same hormones. Identical neurotransmitter cocktails mainline through each of them. They listen to the same nonsense from other people. They look at the same TV programs, and they go to the same parties. And neither hemisphere operates anything on its own, any more than we walk with one foot or the other, or whether the area of a rectangle is dependent on its length or width." Let me just repeat that last sentence or so. Neither hemisphere operates anything on its own, any more than we walk with one foot or the other, or whether the area of a rectangle is dependent on its length or width. Almost nothing is regulated solely by the left or right hemisphere. So now they're going into a section regarding teaching to both halves of the brain. Now, you might think that this might not, refer to you, but think about presentations you might have to make, and raises you might be wanting your boss to make for you, any kind of negotiation, job hunting, a job interview, any of these things, you're actually teaching the other person or people, some information, either about you or, your goals or your experience. And in the case of actual presentations, you could be talking about just about anything. So I think this is interesting to a whole lot of people. Does knowing the special contributions of each hemisphere to information processing mean much to us as educators? Does it help to know that the left hemisphere processes the text and the right provides the context? Maybe there are important implications that go beyond the teaching to the right side of the brain activities we've all heard about and perhaps tried in our classrooms or other teaching environments. Perhaps we need to put more emphasis on teaching to both halves of the brain since they work together all the time. Content, the text, hemisphere excels, is important, but text without content, the specialty of the right hemisphere, is often meaningless. We need to teach content within a context that is meaningful to students or listeners, audience, and that connects to their own lives and experiences. This is teaching to both halves of the brain. Too often, the curriculum or the program is taught in isolation with little effort put into helping students see how the information is or could be used in their lives. Too many students never comprehend the big picture of how the content they are learning fits in the larger scheme of things. How many of you make good grades in certain subjects and have to admit that you've never used what you learned because it was taught out of context? Does what you learned in history help you understand events occurring in the world today? Well, I have to say that talking about, I think it was the oil companies in throughout history, at least in America when we started drilling for oil and everything, there was a lot of fallout that is repeating or has repeated itself with the Middle East oil and the different factions that, you know, are created and then the fighting that occurs between those factions. I mean, some things never really change, just the, you know, the players change. Does the A you earned in algebra assist you in solving problems in your everyday life? If we don't connect the curriculum to the learner's experience, much of the information gets lost, and we waste time having students engage in meaningless memorization rituals. According to David Perkins, we produce students with fragile knowledge that they either don't remember after the test or don't know when or how to use it. Perhaps an increased understanding of the cerebral hemispheres will assist us in designing curriculum and pedagogy that results not only in increased student understanding of information taught, but also in increased ability to use the information appropriately. And, you know, I have to say regarding the do you use algebra to solve problems in your everyday life, it would have been nice to have more direction as far as, you know, if you have a certain algebraic type problems that occur in your life. I mean, I can't right off the bat, you know, think of any in particular, although my sons probably could. But it would have been nice to say, well, if this and this happens, you know, you can utilize your algebra ability to solve these problems and have a little bit more practice with those types of things. I think that now maybe the SAT is gearing more towards those kinds of problems that are about real issues, you know, number of girls in the school versus the number of boys, and, you know, how do you find out, you know, maybe a subset within that or, you know, I don't know. But it seems like it could be made more readily useful if students got practice in specifically applying those concepts to real-world problems. So that's just my two cents. Now, I am going to start another chapter, which is quite interesting. It's how the neurons actually communicate. And so, you know, once we find out about how this happens, you know, we can definitely draw some conclusions about maybe how to create the best environment for our brain and our neurons to communicate and so forth. So this is chapter 4 of the book. And a little side note says, all human behavior can be traced to the communication among neurons. Yeah, that's for sure. You know, all thoughts, all feelings, all beliefs, and all of our behavior and output is all originates with neurons communicating. So if you think about that, you know, the neurons really have a lot of responsibility. All human behavior can be traced to the communication among neurons. Every thought you think, every emotion you feel, every movement you make, your awareness of the world around you, and your ability to read these words are possible because neurons talk to each other, and your ability to hear these words on the radio. How do these cells accomplish such a variety of tasks? What does the communication look like? We once believed that transmission between neurons was simply an electrical current flowing from one neuron to the next. Today, we know that this is true, but only a few of the neurons in the nervous system. Oh, it's true for only a few of the neurons. Our focus will be on the majority of neurons in the mature human brain, which do not communicate solely using electricity. Okay, so we're talking about the action potential, the brain's electrical signal. So this is just the electrical part, I believe. Most neurons communicate with each other by means of both electrical and chemical signals. We have known that for many years that the brain produces some type of electricity. As early as 1875, English physiologist Richard Catton recorded weak electrical currents in the brains of monkeys. It wasn't until 1929, however, that German psychiatrist Hans Berger first recorded electrical signals in the human brain. Today, the currents generated by the billions of neurons in the brain are commonly measured using the EEG, which is the electroencephalogram. What is the source of these electrical signals? How do they compare with the electricity we use to operate our computers and our appliances? Nerve impulses that travel along the axons in neurons are bioelectrical currents, and not the mechanical electrical currents that flow through the wiring in our homes. In our brains, these impulses are the result of the movement of four common ions. Are you ready? Sodium, potassium, calcium, and chloride. And by the way, ions are atoms that have either a positive or negative electrical charge. Positive ions like the sodium, potassium, and calcium ions are atoms that have lost one or more electrons. Negative ions like the chloride atoms are atoms that have gained one or more electrons. The specific channels in the neuron cell membrane allow ions to move from one side of the membrane to the other. Potassium ions are distributed inside the membrane of a neuron at rest. Sodium, calcium, and chloride ions are distributed along the outside of the normally more or less impermeable membrane. The inside of a neuron has a slight excess of negatively charged ions with respect to the outside. The difference, called the resting potential, is usually expressed as a negative value, about 70 thousandths of a volt. In other words, a neuron at rest holds a slight negative charge. And again, that negative charge, that slight negative charge, is called the resting potential, the difference between the inside of the neuron and the outside charge. When nothing much is happening, a neuron usually sends impulses down the axon at a relatively slow, irregular rate. When a neuron is stimulated, receives excitatory signals from another neuron, however, the sodium channels in the membrane open and the positively charged sodium ions enter the cell. This makes the potential difference temporarily more positive inside than outside. As soon as this occurs, however, positively charged potassium ions leave the cell, changing the voltage to a more negative than normal. This brief change in the potential difference usually lasts for about 1 millisecond and is known as an action potential. So it's all about this millisecond, which is called the action potential. The action potential spreads down the axon as the sodium channels open sequentially, somewhat like falling dominoes. Each axon channel opens up the next channel, just as each domino in a line has to knock over only the next. The chain reaction that results is a great energy saver compared to physically pushing over 50 dominoes one by one. This impulse moves only in one direction until it reaches the end of the axon. Though all action potentials have the same intensity, the strength of the message can vary depending on how frequently the action potential is generated. Some neurons can fire up to 500 action potentials a second. Wow, some neurons can fire up to 500 action potentials a second. The more normal rates, however, are 30 to 100 potentials a second. The speed of an action potential varies according to the diameter of the axon and whether or not it is insulated with myelin. I remember that myelin is that fatty substance which covers the axon and makes the transmission of information faster. It's like having insulation on your electrical cords. Okay. And so the speed of an action potential varies according to the diameter of the axon and whether or not it is insulated with myelin. Action potentials travel at speeds up to 220 miles per hour. This speed is much slower than that of a computer, but is fast by biological criteria. So, again, action potentials travel at speeds up to 220 miles per hour. Now that we have taken a look at the electrical component of neural transmission, we are in a better position to understand the chemical component, even though we already touched on ions, which are, part of chemical subject. So the brain's own pharmacy, the chemical signals. During the night of Easter Sunday, 1921, Austrian physiologist Otto Loewi had a dream. Probably pronounced Loewi, but it's L-O-E-W-I. He awoke, jotted down some notes, and went back to sleep in the morning. In the morning, he could not decipher his notes, but he knew that he had written down something important. The next night, he had the same dream and immediately got up and went to his laboratory to perform the experiment suggested by his dream. It was designed around two frog hearts, which were being kept alive in a special oxygenated chamber filled with a fluid similar to that normally found in the body. It was already known that if the vagus nerve, which innervates the heart, is stimulated, the heart slows down. Loewi stimulated the vagus nerve of one of the hearts, then transferred the fluid that had surrounded it to the second heart. Even though the second heart had not been stimulated, it too slowed down. Loewi concluded that there must have been some chemical released into the fluid when the first heart was stimulated. And when that fluid was applied to the second heart, the effects were the same as on the first heart. He called this chemical Vegas stuff, which was identified in 1933 as the transmitter acetylcholine. Discovery of the effect of acetylcholine on the heart was to have profound implications for understanding how neurons communicate with each other. Acetylcholine is one of the brain's own chemical messengers, which are generally called neurotransmitters. Many neurotransmitters today are fairly well known. You've probably heard of dopamine, serotonin, and the endorphins. Many more exist, however, perhaps as many as 100. Some of these neurotransmitters are generated within the cell bodies of neurons, and others are synthesized within the axon terminals. Regardless of their source, all the neurotransmitter molecules are eventually stored in small sacs or vesicles in the bulb-like terminals of the axon. So the terminals meaning the end portion of the axon. And, you know, from that, over the synapse, the electrochemical signal travels. Neurotransmitters are generally either excitatory or inhibitory, meaning that they either increase or decrease the probability that a neuron will fire. At first glance, it might be difficult to see why there would be times when you would want neural activity inhibited. But imagine what it would be like if all the neurons in your motor cortex, or any other part of your brain for that matter, were firing all the time. Neurotransmitters are fascinating chemicals, and we'll take a closer look at them a little later in this chapter. So we have about 3 minutes left, and I'm going to start to talk to you a little bit about the synapse, and we'll probably pick it up there next time. So this is called the synapse. The next step in understanding neural communication is to look at how the electrical and chemical components come together to allow information to be passed from cell to cell within the central nervous system. This all-important action takes place at the junction of the axon terminal of one neuron and a dendrite on the cell body of a second neuron. This junction is known as a synapse. The axon terminal and the membrane of the dendrite are separated by an infinitesimal gap, really, really small gap, called the synaptic cleft. And most synapses take place on the spines of the dendrites, but 15 to 20% of the synapses occur on the cell body itself. Well, that's kind of interesting. I don't think I knew that. When the action potential reaches the terminal of an axon, it stimulates the opening of some of the vesicles and thus triggers the release of one or more neurotransmitters into the synaptic cleft. The neurotransmitter molecules diffuse across the cleft. The more action potentials that arrive at the terminal, the more molecules are released into the gap. The electrical signal of the action potential has now converted into a chemical signal, and the synaptic cleft is crossed within thousandths of a second. At one point, scientists believed that each neuron produced only one neurotransmitter. We now know that a neuron may release two or more transmitters at a single synapse. It may even switch transmitters. Once the neurotransmitter molecules reach the other side of the synapse, each molecule makes contact with its target, the post-synaptic or receiving neuron. How is the contact made? On the dendrite of the receiving neuron are special large protein molecules that are called receptors. Each neurotransmitter has a different shape, and the receptors are specifically designed for the shape of the neurotransmitter they are receiving, as precisely as a key is made for a lock. The neurotransmitter molecule fits into the receptor site, opening or closing ion channels on the membrane of the target neuron. Just as a change in the potential difference of the axon membrane generated an action potential, a change in the potential difference in the membrane of the dendrite causes a stimulation of the target neuron. And I'm going to stop right there, folks. I want to have a wonderful rest of the weekend. Try to stay cool. be kind to your brain. Eat some good brain food like avocados or walnuts. And I hope to hear you back again. See you next Saturday at noon. Thank you on behalf of the Resilient Brain.